This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This recording was made at Reach 2022, a conservative Anabaptist ministry convention hosted by Faith Builders Educational Programs on March 24 and 25, 2022, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Thanks, David, and good morning to everyone.
Good morning.
What do they need to learn? In the General Assembly we just came from, right at the end I started crying because what we really need is to pray for a genuine love for the people that we're serving. And if you have that and it's coming from the bottom of your heart, that will cover a multitude of cultural mistakes that you might make. And we will make mistakes. No amount of training, no amount of equipping will eliminate all the mistakes that we'll make, but pray for a genuine love for the people that we're serving. That is the number one essential. It's not in your handout, but that's the number one essential that you need, is a genuine love for the people. In our 19 years of cross-cultural ministry, we've made a lot of mistakes. The first 9 years, we genuinely loved the people that we were with. They were our equals. Leaving that place and moving back to the United States was the hardest thing that I've ever done in my life. Those were good years. And I'm grateful for the love that God has given us for the people that we were with. And I'm grateful for the experiences that God has given there. Yesterday, I tried in my workshop. My workshop was titled, Why? Why do we do training? And I was trying to build a case for why we do this. Today in this workshop, I want to look at more specifics of what should we be equipping people for. And I'm not going to do all of them. Like, you could probably have days of doing that. Brother Arthur, you could get up here and teach this class too, I'm sure, and others as well. I'd like to give us a few foundational principles just that how I'm approaching this topic first. The first foundational principle is our workers have to be grounded in the Word of God. Like, we have SMBI, EBI, we have Bible schools that do that. And that is just a first kind of a foundational principle that I'm approaching this with. Make sure that your workers are grounded in the Word of God. If you're not sure if you have enough Bible training, before we moved overseas, how long ago? 22 years ago. I asked, can I go to Bible school? Can we go to Bible school for a couple terms before we go? Like, I just want some more input before I go. And our mission board says, yes, that's fine. You might think, well, because your workers or because you, if you're going, I'll be talking both to workers that are going as well as organizations maybe that are sending. You might think that, well, because I grew up in a good, solid church, I'm okay. Don't take that for granted. I was talking with a worker, a cross-cultural worker that was part of a team, and all of the team members came from solid Anabaptist churches. But they realized after they got together as a team and were going into a church planning setting that they had pretty different visions of what this new church plant should look like. And it came down really to differences in biblical understanding, the way we apply the Bible. So make sure that your workers, or that you, if you're going as a worker, make sure that you have a solid biblical foundation. Second kind of foundational principle for this workshop, I'm approaching it from the context of sending workers into a cross-cultural setting. I'll try to keep moving, so if you all on the side can't see, you can be able to see as I move around. I'm not approaching it so much for like preparing workers to go to other forms of local ministry like Mountain View Nursing Home or Faith Mission Home. We prayed for Faith Mission this morning. Those are valid and needed forms of ministry. I'm looking more at going into a cross-cultural setting. So the things that I'm talking about would apply more in that setting than in a setting like Faith Mission Home, although some of them might apply. I'm going to be looking at eight different areas in which that I think are eight essentials, and there are a lot more, as I mentioned. But as I look at those, I want us to be aware of some specific areas in which I think we need to get preparation or training so that we'll be able to thrive in our field of service. I think missions should be about thriving, not just surviving. If you're saying, I'm going to go somewhere, and I think I can stick it out for 2 or 3 years, like, don't even bother going. You're probably going to make more mistakes and more damage than if you just stayed home. But if you say, you know what, I want to do my best. I want to go. I want to get any preparation that I'm able to get. I want to go prepared. I want to go, and I'll be there as long as God wants me there. I want to thrive in ministry. I want to do my best to share the good news of the gospel. Then, by all means, go. First thing, I put this one first. I think it's because it's one of the most important. Again, after having a biblical foundation, a love for God, a love for people, going in as a learner.
Yes.
Go in, be willing to learn from the people. Greg Larson tells a story. He was at a missions conference, and we're talking with people, and a lady came up to him and asked him if he knows anything about elephants. And he's like, I don't know. I mean, they have big ears, but... And she's like, no, more specifically, do you know what happens if there's a herd of elephants around a water hole and another herd of elephants, like, wants to join them at the water hole? And he's like, no, I don't know what they do. And she's like, well, when there's a herd of elephants around a water hole and another herd wants to join them and get water, the lead elephant of the second herd will come up to the first herd that's around the water hole. And as they get close, the lead elephant will turn around and start backing down towards the others. And when their backsides bump into each other, then the first herd feels them, senses them, and then they kind of shuffle aside. And then the elephants from the second group, they turn around and they join them at the water hole. And Greg is like, okay, so what are you trying to say? And then she just simply stated, we didn't back in. When we go into another culture as a learner, it's implying that you're backing in. You're going in gently. When we go charging in with our tusks out in front and we start poking others that are there like these elephants might do, it will cause and does cause a lot of chaos. Too often, we go in thinking that we have all the answers and I'm here to teach. I'll get to that. We earn the right to teach. I'll get to that a little bit later on. I was thinking of some of these things. What are some of the things that we should learn as we go into another culture? Learn to cook their food. These are not in order of importance on this particular point here. I think going in as a learner is of utmost importance. But the different things that we learn. Learn how to cook their food. Like, that might sound simple, but I think there are a lot of cross-cultural workers who'd be like, oil down? Yeah. Actually, it's really good. Fish broth or roti or dumpling or noodles, like, learn how to cook their food. We have many, many good memories around food. And there's something about eating food together that breaks down barriers. It doesn't matter if you're in a little thatch roof and you're eating fried jacks, which are little fish like this, and you eat them with the head and everything yes. on them. Or if you're eating octopus or whatever you're eating. But if you're sitting around and you're eating food together, or if you're at a nice long table with a tablecloth and fine china and you're eating mashed potatoes and roast beef in Lancaster County, something about food breaks down barriers and it breaks down differences. When we turn up our noses at their food, or we're like, yeah, I'm not eating that. It says a lot about how we value them as individuals.
Yes.
Learn how to cook their foods, and when they see you take an interest in that, it's almost a buy-in into the culture. Like, it's, I don't know, it just, I don't know how to explain it. We have a lot of good memories about food. When we lived overseas, I learned how to cook their food. I didn't enjoy cooking in the kitchen as much, but I love cooking over a fire. Get a 3-stone fire in a pot, and you cook oil down or fish broth or palau or pea soup or like these good foods. Like, it's, we had lots of good memories of that. In New York, Learn how to make dumplings and authentic Chinese noodles and do hot pot and some things like that. Like, it's, food is great. Learn how to cook their foods. Learn how to enjoy their foods. Be willing to try their food. Food is an acquired taste. Like, if you watch a baby start to eat solid food, often at the beginning, about half of it comes back out. Some of it, though, will stay, and as they learn to acquire a taste for food, you'll learn to like their food as well. But if you say, nah, that looks sketchy, food is neither right or wrong. It's just different. I'll come back to that one a little later on. Learn the local language. Learn their language. I said yesterday, it's difficult to plant churches if you're doing it only through an interpreter. Learn their language and learn it well. It might take you years to do that, but learn their language and learn it well. It's worth the investment if you're going to do that. In the early 1900s, Cameron Townsend moved to Guatemala, and he was trying to sell Spanish Bibles to the people there, to the Guatemalan people. The problem was about 60% of the population at the time, at least in his area, were indigenous people, and they didn't know Spanish. And some of them came to him, and he was like, they asked him, is like, if your God is so smart, why doesn't he speak our language? And that led him to devoting the next 10 years of his life to translating the Bible into their language, which was unwritten at the time. But he developed, I'm assuming as the story goes, I didn't read all the details, but he developed a language, written language, and translated the Bible into their language. If we think we're so smart, then let's learn their language as well, wherever we're going. It takes time and effort, yes, but it's also worth the effort. Another thing to learn the history of their country and culture. Like, all of these things are, I'm trying to build a case for just showing interest and learning about people. When we go in and say, you know what, I want to learn from you, it puts us in a posture of, I need you, I need what you have to give me, and I want to learn. And then we will earn the right to teach. I remember sitting with some older people, asking them stories about their childhood, what life was like. This is when we were living overseas. What life was like in the 1950s when Hurricane Janet devastated their island, and what it was like. And the stories that she was telling were, I found fascinating. We asked stories about their holidays, like, what holidays should we celebrate as followers of Jesus in your culture? Is Carnival a holiday to celebrate? In that particular culture, across the board, all the believers said, no, Christians don't go to Carnival. Another holiday, Kite Day. Good Friday, Easter Monday, you go out to the point, you cook a pot of food, you fly kites. And, like, is that a holiday that Christians should go to? And across the board, all the Christians are like, yeah, it's a fine holiday. Like, they do church campouts, and they would go out, and they'd fly kites. I asked a Rasta man, why do you fly kites on Good Friday? And he was like, I don't know, because Jesus was flying on the cross. I don't think that's why, but I found it kind of amusing. But ask questions about their holidays. Ask questions about their traditions. Ask questions about their culture and their country. Learn to know their history. Learn culturally appropriate greetings. This is a really big deal in some countries more than others, perhaps. Where we were living, it was a really big deal that you would acknowledge people when you came into a room. Like, you would say good morning or good afternoon, just kind of in general to the people in the room. Like, as you would be coming in the room here, you just like, good morning. You're not really expecting a response, but, like, that was really important. It was a big deal. One day, I was out at my friend's shop, and he pulled me aside, and he's like, Pastor Joel, you need to talk to, and he named a particular missionary, American missionary. I was like, why? And he's like, he's so selfish. Well, selfish in that context meant he kept to himself, like, not greedy, like we would kind of think of selfish. And I was like, why? What's he doing? And he's like, well, he doesn't say good morning to anyone. Like, digging into the story a bit more, this particular shop, the goods were behind the counter, and my friend, the shopkeeper, would be there talking with his friends or hanging out after work or whatever. This other foreign worker would come into the shop, and he would politely wait his turn. At least he thought he was being polite. He'd politely wait his turn. He didn't want to interrupt the conversation. And he would, you know, wait until they're done talking, and then he'd step up to the counter to like a bag of flour and a pound of rice or whatever, and he'd pay, and he'd go his way. His problem, and it was like a really big deal, was he wouldn't say good morning. And he was trying to be polite by American terms by not interrupting the conversation, but actually in local terms he was being really selfish, really breaking cultural norms. My biggest clash on this particular one came when I was invited to have prayer with the prime minister and his cabinet. So every Monday morning for a month, our church was selected to send the pastor, which was me at the time, to go into the capital city and have Bible reading and prayer with the prime minister, who was the highest person in the country, and his cabinet. So picture yourself as an American, or picture me as an American. I come into the room, the prime minister and his cabinet are talking. Now, am I supposed to interrupt him and say, good morning, the right honorable Dr. Keith Mitchell and cabinet? Or am I supposed to wait until he's done talking, acknowledges me, and then say my greeting that I just gave you? I still don't know what was right. I waited. And then I did greet him the way I was supposed to and had a Bible reading and prayer with him. But we have these clashes of culture, and I think it's really important to learn what is appropriate, learn what is considered rude, what is considered kind. And sometimes the things that are considered rude in our culture are considered normal in another culture. What's considered rude in their culture might be considered normal in ours. Another thing that I thought about in this point is going in as a learner is learn the difference between right, wrong, and different. We tend to put things in right or wrong. If they fit my frame of reference, it's right. If it doesn't, it's wrong. Now, we know we go to the Bible for what's right and wrong, but there are a lot of things that aren't really right or wrong. They're just different. If you eat octopus and, possum and iguana, that's not right or wrong. It's just different. I personally don't like possum, but iguana and octopus are great. Some people, they're like, no, like, that's wrong. Like, you don't do that. No, a lot of things are just, they're culturally not right or wrong. They're just different. Learn what categories to put things into. One thing that is wrong is when we have a parent-child mentality, or view that, like, we're always right. Being ethnocentric, my way is always the right way. That's a wrong way to approach life. We need to be careful that we don't come into other cultures feeling superior. We need to go in as a learner, and then eventually, hopefully, we can become their equals, but never superior to the people we're serving. I say at best, we come in under them, and then we graduate up to being their equal, but we're never superior to them. In Christ, there is no difference, and they are just as intelligent, just as loved by God as anyone else, and we have the privilege of sharing the gospel with them. But if we say, well, that's just wrong, like, you don't do that, like, church never starts at 6 o'clock in the morning, actually it's just different. I mean, if you want, I personally don't like going to church at 6 o'clock in the morning, but if that's when church starts, it's not right or wrong, it's simply different. I think maybe the importance of going in as a learner, that's probably just the, I think it's the one thing that I want you to take away from this today, because as we go in as a learner, it demonstrates humility, it demonstrates, I need you, I'm not superior to you, I need you. We earn the right to teach by first demonstrating that we're teachable. Let me keep moving on. A good book that would continue on this by Dwayne Elmer, Cross-Cultural Servanthood. It's an excellent book. Covers a multitude of just cross-cultural avenues of ways we can learn from the people that we are going to serve. Second main point that I have 8 of these being willing, actually I have nine if I have time, being willing to embrace suffering and hardships. Too often we view ministry as like, I'm just going to transport my comfortable American lifestyle to wherever we want to go. And like, I want it easy. I want it comfortable. I want, you know, everything is good there. I think we need to be prepared to suffer hardship. Be prepared for suffering. Obviously, some places of ministry are very easy. They really are. Where we lived was not that difficult. Some places are much more difficult. I have a friend in another culture who once told me, he's like, these missionaries don't really care about us. They're just here on vacation. Mm-hmm. Apparently, I don't know all the context, but apparently behind that statement were missionaries who weren't ready for suffering or hardship. They wanted to transport their American comfortable lifestyle to the place where they were serving, and it wasn't received very well. A question to ask is like, how am I living regarding or related to the people around me? I'm thinking more of a financial level here especially. Am I like at this financial level, that's how I'm living? I'm not talking what money do you have in the bank in the United States, but how are you actually living out your life compared to the people you're serving? If you're at a really big difference to the people that you're serving, that has a potential for creating problems. I believe that the way that we live our life on the mission field says a lot about how much we value the people that we're serving. And I keep coming using the phrase, the people that we're serving, and I believe that missions is about service. It's not about creating dependencies, and I want to touch on that in the end. There's a big, big difference between those two. But we are servants of Jesus Christ. We have the message of the gospel to take to people, and we are to go in to serve, to share the good news, to work alongside, and to plant churches and make disciples of Jesus. Are you willing to embrace suffering and hardship? And this looks different depending on what context you're in. So I can't definitively say what it's going to look like for you. But I clearly remember September 9, 2004. It's almost 18 years ago. But the reason I remember that, it was a Thursday. On Tuesday, September 7, Hurricane Ivan had devastated the country where we were living. About 95% of the houses were damaged or destroyed. Our house had been damaged, but we were able to patch the roof back on temporarily enough on Wednesday, the day after. On Thursday, we had about two dozen of our neighbors that were taking refuge in our home until we could do something a little better for them and get their house patched back. We didn't have any electricity. The infrastructure was devastated. We had no idea when electric would be back on. It ended up being about 3 months for us. We had no running water. We had no idea when that was coming back. So we were going to the river to bathe and to wash clothes and to get drinking water, like anything we could find. The local grocery stores had been looted, and the ones that weren't looted were closed, and we had no idea when we were getting food back. At the southern end of the country, there was a medical school that had a lot of foreign students, and they were doing anything they could to get out of the country. The airport was closed, but there were a couple planes that were able to get in and out, and they were paying big money just to get out of the country. And I remember this Thursday afternoon thinking, I wish I could just leave, but instantly it came back, like, I can't leave. And it wasn't because I couldn't physically leave. But I was like, I can't leave. These are my people. Like, we are in this together. Our lives were no longer in danger. There was no military coup or something that we had to leave because our lives were in danger. But I'm like, we're in this together. If we bail out now, it will only solidify the misconception that missionaries don't work. They just live in their highfalutin houses, et cetera, et cetera. The next, I would say, 2 to 3 months were probably the most intense of our life. But they were also the best of our lives because we developed relationships that had already been there, but they deepened and we bonded in ways that never would have happened had we not gone through that together. I'm grateful for that opportunity. I don't really want to go through another hurricane, at least not like that. But I'm grateful for the opportunity because we're like, we're in this together. And you might say that wasn't really a hardship. And looking back, God gave us grace for what we needed and we got through it. It was challenging, but we were in this together. And I'm grateful for the opportunity for that. Had we simply left, we would have missed the opportunity to bond in a deeper level. And it took our relationship to a whole different level because of that experience. Your hardships might look different. Like what God is calling you to suffer and endure might look very different. It might be leaving your family and making new friends and family. It might mean learning another language. It might mean learning deep new foods or how to wash your clothes in the river or... I don't know, taking public transportation instead of having your own vehicle. I don't know what your hardship has looked like, but I think it is important that we prepare workers for suffering and hardship. Following Jesus isn't promised to be an easy life. The next one that I have, actually just a little sub-point there, we have to be willing to suffer hardship if we want to be effective in sharing the gospel. Surrendering our rights. There's a little book by Mabel Williamson that I have titled, Have We No Rights? And the answer is really, as a follower of Jesus, we don't have rights. We have to give up our rights. And I think too often in cross-cultural work, we don't surrender our rights. I think this one is especially hard for us as Americans because we like to be right in basically everything. We need to surrender our right to a normal way of life. And I put normal in quotes because I'm not even sure what normal is. Steve said this morning, like, normal was living on a farm milking cows. That actually seems very abnormal to me, but if that was normal to him, I mean, that's fine. But just surrendering your right to a normal way of life, like, that is a right we have to give up. Surrendering our right to privacy. I think about after Hurricane Ivan, we were for, I don't know, it seemed like a long time, but my wife and I were on the bottom bunk, and there was another local pastor family couple, and his wife were on the top bunk, and we lived that way for a while. It was not something that you want to do like all the time, but it's like, you know what? Sometimes your right to privacy is different, or it's invaded, and am I okay? I'm not saying we lived the rest of our time there that way. We didn't. But am I willing to surrender my right to privacy and like, oh, I'll keep my private space? And sometimes we think more of just like personal space, not like modesty type privacy, but just like personal space. Like, I don't want to get too close to people. How about the right to my own time? Am I willing to allow people to interrupt my time? Like, you can't come and interrupt my time. I'm studying for a sermon, or I'm studying to teach Bible club, or whatever it is. Like, no, if we're called to be a cross-cultural worker, if we're called for ministry, we are there to interact with people. And so if these seem like interruptions, actually maybe God brought them because there's a need in their life, or maybe because he's trying to teach me something. A right to a safe, comfortable way of life, giving up the American dream. Maybe God will call you to a difficult place that won't be, like, physically safe. Maybe it will be challenging. We have workers not... in the Anabaptist communities, there are workers in places like Poland or Romania that are helping with the Ukrainian crisis now. Just surrendering the right to be right. Like, I don't have to be right. I don't have to have the last word unless it's yes, ma'am. I don't have to have the last word, just the right. My wife is not that way, okay? Just for the record, I have the best wife. We've been married 25 years. As a follower of Jesus, really, do we have rights? I would say no, we don't. Like, Jesus gave up everything to come here. He gave up the right to be right. He gave up the right to privacy. He gave up the right to wealth. He gave the right to glory to come here to be our Savior, and we owe everything to him. Good cross-cultural skills, I think, are important in another area in which I think training is important. Again, Elmer's book would touch on this. I wasn't sure what all to put under this, like subpoints. One of them is learning how different cultures view time. Soon after we moved to the city, a Bengali friend of mine wanted me to go with him to help him buy a mattress at a local shop, which was owned by Chinese people. And his English was not very good, and the shopkeeper's English was not very good, and so he wanted me to be there kind of as the mediator. I was kind of the common denominator, in hopefully I could kind of interpret his English and interpret her English, and together we could buy these mattresses. So we agreed that we were going to be, I think it was a Tuesday morning at 9 o'clock, and I forgot about it until about 10 till 9. I was working at my desk, and all of a sudden it's like, oh boy, I'm supposed to be down on Broadway in 10 minutes. And so I quickly dropped what I was doing, and I ran so I could get down there. Like, I literally ran most of the way down there. And I got there, like, 10 o'clock, or 9 o'clock, sorry, I got there, and my friend's not there. And so I waited and waited, and about 45 minutes later, he shows up. He doesn't apologize for being late. We go into the shop, and we buy the mattress. It's actually buying two mattresses. And then the shopkeeper says, actually, the mattresses aren't here. They're at the warehouse across the street. So you go down the street and across the street, and you can get them over there. And so we go over there, and the person's like, oh, I'm sorry, I have the one mattress in stock, but the other one is on the truck. It's on the way. It'll be here in a couple hours. And my friend kind of mutters under his breath, what, 2 hours? That's a long time to wait. And I'm thinking, yeah, I just waited 45 minutes on here. It's possible, though, that in his culture, if you said 2 hours, you actually meant it won't be here until tonight. Like, I'm not exactly sure, but it's like in how you communicate time. So in the end, we left, and they said they were going to deliver the mattress to his apartment that afternoon when it comes. I'll pick up that story a little bit later on here. But just learning how to communicate time. Like, time is very different depending on where you're going. Warm climate, time, it's more about the event and the relationship than it is about the time. We are very time conscious. Like, we watch clocks, and that's part of our culture. Some cultures aren't that much. We can get really frustrated as Americans, and that frustration will show if we go into other cultures and like, well, this is stupid. You told me you're going to be here at 9 o'clock, and like, why aren't you here? Like, you can't be trusted, and like, we start passing judgment based on different views of time. I think just having that awareness is really important as we go into other cultures. In communicating, learn whether to be direct or indirect. In New York, I'm never quite sure if people are responding from New York culture or from their home culture. Because in their home culture, some of them would tend to be very indirect. But in New York, because it's American culture, kind of American culture, we tend to be more direct. And so I'm never always sure which way we're responding. So if I ask someone a question, do I ask them a direct question or an indirect question? I was talking with a group of people that we normally have a Bible study with after our church service. We'll normally have a Bible study with that particular group because it helps them to understand with the language barrier a little bit more. And most of the people that were going to be in that group that particular Sunday were not there. And so I was asking the one couple that was there, like, would you like to have a Bible study? Like, we can have a Bible study just the three of us. Or would you like to just wait until the other, like, four or five others that were not there that Sunday, we can wait till next Sunday? And they kind of hedged on an answer, and I wasn't sure, like, what they were saying. And so I asked them again, and they kind of gave another answer. But I wasn't, again, I was asking a direct question to a person whose home culture was very indirect. If I ask them a direct question, they're kind of bound by politeness to say what they think I want them to say. Another person was listening who wasn't part of the conversation, but he was listening from a similar culture. And he told me, he's like, what they're really saying is, and then he in essence translated for them. And they're like, I could kind of see the sigh of relief. Like, they no longer had to tell me what they thought I didn't want to hear. But if he told me, then it was fine. Like, he's just a messenger communicating the message. Like, learning how to communicate, whether it's direct or indirect. Let me go back to, my time's running on here. Let me go back to the mattress story. So I'm thinking about cross-cultural communication and how different cultures, we just look at things different. So the mattresses, the one mattress ended up not being delivered. So my friend the next day called me and it's like, can you go with me? Well, actually, he called me that afternoon. He said he changed his mind. He doesn't want it anymore. It's going to be like on back order or something. And he just wants a refund. Can I go with him the next morning? As soon as the shop opens, we'll go back to the shop and we'll meet them and ask for a refund for the undelivered mattress. And so, like, sure, no problem. So we went down there and he was there at that time. When the shop opened, we waited. We walk into the shop, and at the far end of the shop, this is in New York, the lady is there. There's like a little altar, and she's burning incense, and she's saying a prayer or something to this idol that she has at the far end of her shop. And so we walked into the shop. We were like the first people of the day, and then we waited till she was done. She turned around, and we told her why we were there. We'd like a refund on this mattress. And she's like, oh, no, you can't do that. Like, in our culture, like you can't ask for a refund on something the first thing in the day. And I remembered a conversation that I had when we were in Thailand. And in the Thai culture, if the first customer of the day that comes into the shop, like, that kind of sets the tone for the whole day. So if the first person that comes in the shop doesn't buy anything, you're going to have bad luck all day. Or if the first person wants a refund, that's extra bad. And so I just like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't think about that. This is why I told the lady in New York. It's like, I'm sorry, I didn't think about that. And you're like, would it be better if we come back this afternoon? She's like, yeah, it'd be much better. So we left, and we came back in the afternoon. There's no problem. Like, we got the refund. There's no – but just understanding differences in culture that we can go in as like, well, that's dumb. Like, this is America. Like, why aren't you giving me a refund on my mattress? But like, no, it's like, just roll with it. When we go into another culture, I think it's especially important that we understand good cross-cultural communication. I'm still learning on a lot of these. I'm going to have to keep moving on here. I'm too stalled. Team relationships and peacemaking, I think this is a really important aspect of preparing workers for ministry. How can you prepare workers for this? You can take personality profiles and spiritual gifts assessments. I think this is important because I know you've heard it many times before, but I'll say it again. A huge reason why workers leave the field is because of interpersonal relationships with team members. We believe that taking personality profile tests, like figuring out, like, how did God make me? What spiritual gifts do I have? And then being able to match those with the gifts, like matching the team, look for the different gifts that you need on the team. Be alert to maybe potential challenges that you might have with different personalities. Personalities might clash a bit more. This is never an excuse for just saying, well, hey, I'm a D personality. If you don't like it, you can lump it. Like, that's never an excuse for wrong behavior, but rather it's a tool that we can use. How has God gifted me? We want to be able to put people in the right positions based on the gifts that we have. In Ephesians 4, God says that he gave the church different gifts, and he gave them for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ, for the equipping of the saints, to build up the church. Like, God gave us these gifts. Let's find out what God gave us. How did he equip us so we can be matched with responsibilities that fit those gifts? I talked with a worker once, and they felt a particular calling, a specific calling to a particular area, but the gifts that they had didn't match the responsibilities that they were going to be given. But they were like, well, God called us to this area, so I guess that's what's available, that we'll do that. It didn't work very well because the gifts that they had, they were great. It was a great person, but they were put in responsibilities that didn't match their gifts, and it didn't go well. So make sure that you match the gifts that God has given with the responsibilities that we have. As you think of your team, I think it's also important that you look for different personalities to round out your team, to give it a well-balanced approach. We were looking for a couple to join our team at the MTC, and we recognized that we were lacking in some personalities. We use the DISC personality profile. We were lacking D's and I's on the team, and we really wanted a couple that had that. It just gives a different element, different insights. If we're all S's and C's, we'll get the details hashed out, but we might get bogged down in the details. God brought us a couple that has some of the D and the I personalities that we were lacking, and I'm grateful for that. Another point, I think, another essential, is repairing the past. This comes from Gordon MacDonald, A Resilient Life. Looking into your own story and repairing that first so that you're at a healthy emotional place before you can go out to help others. I'm not suggesting there's got to be some garbage back there somewhere. Let me go digging until I can find something so I can repair it, and then I'm ready. Like, no, but do take a look at your own story. Are there areas in my own life that I need to take care of before I'm at a healthy emotional place, emotionally healthy place, to help others? I'm grateful for places like Life Ministries and other places like that that have trained workers who can help us with our stories. I received help with my own story from Life, and I'm grateful for their help with me as I work through some aspects of my own story. I say we have to be at peace with our own story before we're able to help others repair their story. Sustainability in ministry. We have several workshops here at Reach talking about avoiding burnout and sustainability in ministry, but I think this is an important one as well. I'm not going to repeat their workshop. Clarify expectations. Like, just talk through what the expectations are before you get involved in ministry, or if you're sending workers, so they know what the expectations are. Have healthy boundaries, boundaries in work, boundaries in family, boundaries in marriage. Define your priorities. Have someone to keep you accountable to these priorities and goals. This all can lead towards sustainability in ministry. A book I really like, David Murray, Reset. There's a host of other good books out there. There's probably more in the bookstore if you want books on sustainability in ministry. But I think sometimes we view ministry as like, we've got to give it everything we got, and the needs are so great. Dr. Swenson, in his book, The Overload Syndrome, says that no matter when you stop, it's always arbitrary. There's always more work to be done. There's always more people that you could be encouraging. There's always more emails that you could answer. But he's like, the reality is, in ministry, the work is never done. And so we have to be able to set boundaries, clarify what the expectations are, so we can be sustainable in ministry. And I think that's an important conversation to have with workers before you go into ministry. Two other areas yet. I'm not sure if these are on your handouts or not. Avoiding dependencies. Thinking through the importance of what is our exit strategy in ministry, and then filtering what we're doing in light of that exit strategy. How are we going to complete the work? First of all, what are we trying to accomplish? And then how are we going to complete the work? And then is what I'm doing today helping me towards that? Or is it creating a dependency that's going to hinder us from being able to leave? When we were in ministry overseas, I started looking at some things like, you know, if we're going to work ourselves out of a job, as was, and I think still is, the goal of the ministry, like, how are we going to do this? Is what I'm doing today helping me towards that end, or am I just creating more dependencies? Like, I think it's an important conversation to have, and an ongoing conversation. Have it with your mission board. Have it with your coworkers. Have it with the people that you're serving. It's like, you know, we don't want to be here forever. We want you to be able to, telling the local people, we want you to be able to own this and take it, and then you go out and send other workers out. So how can we think about us stepping back from the work? So think your exit strategy through, and then filter what you're doing today in light of that. One other area yet, and this one is a variety of things, but just more field-specific training. So if you're going to, depending on where you're going, maybe you need religion-specific training. So if you're going to be working in an Islamic country, maybe you want more training or need more training specifically on how to reach Muslims with the gospel. What are the common obstacles to sharing the gospel with Muslims? Or if you're going to Cambodia, how to reach Buddhist people. Or if you're going to maybe work in a childcare facility, maybe childcare training. How to reach hurting and abused children if you're going to be working at, Light of Hope Orphanage in Mexico. If you're going to be working with ladies, women who are trafficked or in that industry, get Restore training. How to reach out to women who are in a traffic situation. Crisis prevention training or ESL training. Like, the list could go on and on and on, but depending on where you're going, get specific field training that's related specifically to that, in addition to what some of these others have said. So again, this morning, just restating what I started with, I want us to become aware of some of the specific areas in which cross-cultural workers need to be prepared. so that you'll get the training that you need in order to thrive in ministry. Like, that's why I'm hoping that you're here. And here's my ask. This is what I want you to do. Based on what you've heard and across Reach yesterday, today, which areas do you want to get more training in? Which areas do you plan to get more training in? And who are you going to have? Who are you going to have to hold you accountable to doing that? I don't want you to walk out the door and say, oh, that's cool, like, I'm going to do this sometime. No, I want you to pick out someone. Think of someone in your mind. It's like, I really would like to get more training in these areas. I'm going to choose this person and tell him of my intention, or that person or her of my intention, and I want her, him or her to check up on me and hold me accountable to this. Like, how are you going to do that? Do I have any time left? 1 minute? Time's up. Mine just flipped to 45, so I will stop. Thank you. I was hoping I could do some Q&A. We'll do that afterwards. I'll turn the time back over to David. Thanks.
Thank you for listening. All recordings from Reach 2022 are available from Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. To purchase additional recordings from Reach or other Faith Builders events, visit us online at www.christianlearning.org or call us at 814-789-4769.